Morning. As we consider the book of Daniel, I think one of the main things to do to start out is to first discuss when it was written. And for that, I am relying on to some extent, you knowing your Old Testament history. But if you would like, just turn to the last couple chapters of 2 Kings. And as you may recall, the Israelites had a near constant problem with apostasy, with abandoning the worship of God and following after the Baals, following after idols, false gods, etc. And really, when you look at the kingdom of Judah, you just have a handful of so-called good kings. You have David. You have Solomon, although he apostatized because of his wives. And it does indicate that towards the end of his life, he did return to the Lord. And I hope that's the case for his sake. But then after that, you run mostly through a series of bad kings and okay kings. You have Jehoshaphat, who's an okay king. But then after a long series of dark times, you have the king Hezekiah. And then following his reign, you have his son Manasseh. And Manasseh was not only bad, he was basically the worst. Now, there were a lot of kings in Israel, or maybe I shouldn't say a lot, but there were quite a few kings who, it says, made their sons or made their children pass through the fire. That is a reference to human sacrifice. Hezekiah was his father's heir, and his father died relatively young, and Hezekiah took to the throne relatively young. He was probably his father's firstborn. I'm a little bit indebted, or a lot indebted, to a scholar named Edwin Thiel. And he did a work called The Mysterious Numbers of the Hebrew Kings. What he was trying to do was line up the chronologies based on the years, et cetera, that it says the kings reigned. And if it works out, Hezekiah's father was only 16 years older than he was and became king when his father passed away. And it says that his father made his children pass through the fire. Well, the way this worked in ancient times was when you're the king, you are the representative of your people, and you are supposed to be an example of piety. So everything you did was in public. And if you follow the story of Hezekiah as we have it, he spent a good part of his reign tearing down altar after high place, after altar, after Asherah pole, and eliminating all of this ungodly worship that amounts to an abomination. So when Hezekiah's father is doing these things in public, and I want you to think about this because it's going to pop up again and again. When these kings made their sons pass through the fire, the people that went and witnessed this, and there were supposed to be a lot of them, they didn't sit there and think, oh, how awful. They sat there and thought, wow, what a pious king. He's so pious and he's so worried about the gods and their favor that he's willing to sacrifice his own child. That's literally what they were supposed to be thinking. So Hezekiah would have been watching. His father would have made him watch these things. So imagine Hezekiah as a boy, very tender age, watching his siblings be offered through fire. I have no doubt that that had a very strong impression on a young Hezekiah. And I wonder if that wasn't playing, those images and memories weren't playing through his mind as he tore down those altars and those Asherah poles and those abominations. Then we get to the Manasseh. He was also young. Chapter 21, after his father Hezekiah dies. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hephzibah. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed. He raised up altars for Baal and made a wooden image as Ahab king of Israel had done. And he worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. He also built altars in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem I will put my name. And he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. Also he made his son pass through the fire, which is a reference to human sacrifice. Practiced soothsaying, used witchcraft, consulted spiritists and mediums. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger, and he even set a carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of the Lord, which the Lord had said to David and Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. And I will not make the feet of Israel wander any more from the land which I have given their fathers, only if they are careful to do according to all that I have commanded them and according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded. But they paid no attention. And Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. So his son Amon continues in his father's footsteps. Verse 22. He forsook the Lord God of his fathers and did not walk in the way of the Lord. Then the servants of Amon conspired against him and killed the king in his own house. Now, I only read that for two reasons. One, Amon continued in his father's ways. And Amon had a conspiracy against him. And I point that out because Manasseh reigned for 55 years, and he was a horrible man. But I want to point this out because there can be a lot of confusion about what constitutes a wicked person in this world. Most wicked people do not walk around, you know, wearing black cloaks, carrying a black cat, or have some type of raven or crow perched on their shoulder, and they cackle and when they laugh, and et cetera, et cetera. Most evil and wicked people in this world are good people. The fact that Manasseh reigned for 55 years tells us that a lot of guys probably thought he was a good guy. He may have had a good sense of humor. He may have been very gregarious and had a great personality. He may have been very generous. He may have hosted all kinds of feasts and had people come into his palace. He may have been a good guy. I like Manasseh. He's a good guy. He's funny. He likes to go on hunts. He likes to hunt. He likes to do art. He may have had all kinds of hobbies that people thought were neat. And all of this is a form of seduction. It's all a vast trick. And all of these features of Manasseh, you can apply to the little horn that we read about in the book of Daniel, chapter 7. Because that's the most important aspect of the book of Daniel. And then after Amon, we have Josiah. Josiah was a good king. And he was very young when his father died. And in the 17th year of his reign, they find the book of the law. And when the book of the law is read to him, one of those men is Hilkiah the priest, and his son was Jeremiah, by the way. But when the book of the law is read to Josiah, he realizes that the children of Israel have so erred from the truth that he responds by tearing his clothes. That's the kind of thing you do when you find out that your child dies, that you have to bury one of your own children. That's when you rip your clothes. So that's a measure of just how upset Josiah was. And the Bible goes to great lengths in the next couple chapters to describe the reform that takes place as a result of Josiah getting his hands on the book of the law and understanding what the covenant was and what it entailed. Because you have to understand that this hadn't been followed since the previous century in the time of his great-grandfather Hezekiah. Worship of God had been so polluted. Josiah was a good king, but he also died young. And this also factors into the book of Daniel. So, verse 26 of 2 Kings 23. Nevertheless, the Lord did not turn from the fierceness of his great wrath, with which his anger was aroused against Judah because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. Because of all the provocations. So even though Josiah is a good king and a good man and he's restored worship, because of what a previous king had done, Josiah has to die because there's a sequence of empires that the book of Daniel tells us about. And the time is ripe for that first one. In Daniel chapter 2, we'll see that it's the head of gold. In Daniel chapter 7, we see that it is the lion, the winged lion. That power, which is called the Neo-Babylonian Empire, sometimes it's called the Chaldean Empire, it's the one headed by Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel. It's ready to take over. So God has the timing of all these things down. The reason Josiah had to die is so that the sequence of events could take place as God has preordained. And the other thing that God understands, according to the 116th Psalm, is that precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. Josiah's soul is secure. So whether he's living here or living in the waiting place that in the New Testament we call paradise, it's ultimately of little consequence to the Lord. And we see that also in the book of Daniel. In Daniel chapter 12, Daniel's got some questions he wants to ask. And he's told, go your way, Daniel. Go your way. This is stuff that you don't need to know. But be assured that when the time comes, you will be resurrected and you will receive your inheritance. That's what's the most important. Josiah, I have every confidence, is one of those men who is going to be resurrected on the last day, and he's going to receive an eternal inheritance. So his purpose has been fulfilled. But it's worth noting that just because we have a good guy, a verifiably good guy here with Josiah, doesn't mean that the Lord won't remove him in order to achieve his greater purpose. We understand from the Exodus that the Lord will raise up certain people at certain times because they suit his purpose. Josiah was one of those men, but so was, as we will see, Nebuchadnezzar. Josiah's time was in the past. He had done what he was supposed to do. The time for Nebuchadnezzar was now. So the Lord understands all things. He sees the end from the beginning. And there is nothing that is in his purview. Everything is in his purview. And because he sees the end from the beginning, he can get the timing of all of these things down perfectly. And it all, for us, the most important thing is to just understand that the Lord is trustworthy regarding these things. Peter told us that the Lord is not slack concerning his promises, as some count slackness. The Lord has promised us certain things, and we just have to trust that when the time comes, he's going to do right by us. When the time comes, he's going to do right by Josiah. When the time comes, he's going to do right by Manasseh. When the time comes, he's going to do right by Nebuchadnezzar. When the time comes, he's going to do right by you and I. In Isaiah, the 55th chapter, we're reminded that his thoughts are not our thoughts. And his ways are not our ways. I have 4 children. The oldest one is about to turn 9 here in a couple weeks. My thoughts are higher than their thoughts. My ways are higher than their ways. I expect from them, because of that, that they will yield to me in everything. If they want to go this route, but I know this route is better, I'm going to guide them in that route. Someday, after I'm done training them up in the way that they should go, my wife and I'm going to watch whether they go the way I think they should have gone. Not in every instance, but overall, as a general direction. And that's the choice that God leaves to each of us. But it's also not really any different for nations. And so in Daniel chapter 7, we have this interesting sequence where in Daniel chapter 1, you have a personal narrative. Then in chapter 2, you have a vision. Then in chapter 3, you have a personal narrative. In chapter 4, it's a personal narrative, but it's quite different because you also have a vision. Nebuchadnezzar receives 2 dreams. Now, that's not a small thing to me. I want you to think about that. How many times in the Bible how many times in the Bible do we have a record of a pagan receiving visions from God? It's not very often. I'll assure you that. So here we have a pagan king, the most powerful king of his day, the richest king of his day. He could stand up in those hanging gardens of Babylon that Herodotus loved so much and look out over the plain of Mesopotamia, and from one end of heaven to the other, he was the king. And this is the man that the Lord chose to send two of these visions, because it's the book of Daniel, and we often think of Daniel's receiving visions, but it is important to note that in chapter 2 and in chapter 4, it's actually Nebuchadnezzar who receives two visions. The first one is a statue, and with the head of gold. And in Daniel chapter 4, it's a vision of a tree, which will perhaps remind you of some visions that we have in the book of Ezekiel. Probably not by accident. Daniel does not actually receive his first vision, if you want to turn to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel does not actually receive his first vision until nearly 50 years, about 50 years after Daniel chapter 1. If we were had continued on in 2 Kings, we would have seen that after Josiah, several of his sons have short reigns. And what we understand is that there's a back and forth between Egypt and Babylon about who's going to control the people of Israel. So Necho, the Egyptian pharaoh, comes up and places his king on the throne. Nebuchadnezzar is going to swoop in and place his own king on the throne. And eventually, in this tug of war, Nebuchadnezzar is going to win. And then Zedekiah is going to rebel. Jehoiachin is going to do the same. So eventually, Nebuchadnezzar swoops into Jerusalem and he takes some people captive. And then about 11, 12 years later, he comes in 586 B.C., and actually destroys Jerusalem and the temple. And that is the end of an age. That's the end of the first, what's called the first temple period. So everything leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem and its temple was the culmination of one particular age. From that point, most of the leaders of Israel have been transplanted to Babylon and in the surrounding regions of Mesopotamia, southern Mesopotamia. Daniel is one of those individuals, as are the Jews who are most commonly referred to as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He was probably transported to Babylon in the first year that Nebuchadnezzar showed up at Babylon. So if we look at the first couple verses, it says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim of Judah into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure of his house. And then that instance there is probably, look back to 2 Kings real quick. At the end of chapter 23, we have first Jehoahaz, who was 23 years old, and he was the king that Necho came and placed on the throne. And then in 35 of chapter 2 Kings 23, it says, so Jehoiakim gave the silver and gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land to give money according to the command of Pharaoh. He exacted the silver and gold from the people of the land, from everyone according to his assessment, to give it to Pharaoh Necho. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zebudah, the daughter of Pedaiah of Rumah, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done. In his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. Then he rebelled against him, and the Lord sent against him various bands of people. Excuse me. And then in verse 8, after that reign, after the reign of Jehoiakim, we have Jehoiachin. He was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. gives his mother's name, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father had done. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. So this is a second time that Judah is besieged. And it goes on to describe the captivity of Jerusalem in verse 13. It says, "And he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king's house, and he cut in pieces all the articles of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, as the Lord had said. Also, he carried into captivity all Jerusalem." So a lot of people call this the captivity of Jerusalem, and then there's the last one. So there's three separate times here that Nebuchadnezzar comes against Jerusalem. The first one is in 605 B.C. The second one is 597, and then the last one is 586-7. And that is the last one we have in chapter 25, where it describes the fall of Judah and the destruction of the temple. So what we're told here is that Daniel went with probably just a small group of the sons of the upper class people to Babylon. And it says in verse 3, "Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles." And it goes on to describe this process of educating Daniel and these young Jewish men as Babylonians. And this is extremely important to understand what's going on here, because when you look back at the story of Manasseh, what it described his actions as doing was seducing the children of Israel. Seduction is a process. And what the goal is to get someone to turn from one direction and go in a different direction. And how does he do it? Well, it's described here. Verse 4, "Young men in whom there was no blemish, but good looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies, and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king." So there's two things that he mentions here. One is teaching them the language. And the second one is providing them a new diet based on the king's delicacies. Language is critically important to understanding the book of Daniel and subsequent history. If you were to read certain kinds of books that talk about linguistics and the development of language, what linguists will tell you is that language is culture. Language is culture. And so what Nebuchadnezzar is trying to do is get these young men, these young Jews, to learn the language of his culture. And what we now know about the development of our brains and the way we learn is that the language you grow up speaking has a huge impact on the way that you think. And that's basically what they mean by language is culture. There are languages on this earth spoken today that the people are so simple, and their language is so simple, and they live such a simple lifestyle that they don't even have a word for theft. Well, if you don't have a word for theft, how do you conceive of theft? And the answer is simply, you don't. If you don't have a word for theft in the language that you speak, then it's really hard for you to gauge what theft is. They don't have words for adultery in some of these languages, because adultery doesn't happen. Now, granted, these are societies and languages that we would all here consider pretty primitive. But that's kind of the point, because what does the New Testament speak of? It talks about the simplicity which is in Christ Jesus. And Paul would tell the Corinthians to be wise concerning good and simple concerning evil. And simple is not stupid. It just means inexperienced. And so when he's trying to get them to learn a new language, what he's really doing is trying to get them to think in new ways, to broaden their horizons, to open themselves up to Babylonian ways. And that's the process that essentially Manasseh did as well. It lists all the gods that Manasseh tricked the people of Judah into worshiping. And all of those were features of outside religions that through the kings, primarily, were allowed to infiltrate the Israelites, and then when they were taken captive by Assyria, then also the kingdom of Judah, until by the time you get to Josiah, God has already determined that what has come before is so bad that that era has to come to an end, and a new one has to rise to take its place. So secondly, he gives them food to drink. He gives them food and drink from his table. This is another theological feature of the Bible. When you go back all the way to creation, God planted a garden and he put man in it and he told man how to tend it. Now this concept of a garden is pretty simple. It's an orchard type situation, and man was given food to eat from the things that he was cultivating. God obviously taught Adam and Eve how to cultivate a garden. Tables are an invention of man. And these kings' tables would have been heaped up with all of the lavish foods from various cultures and various traditions. These kings in Mesopotamia gathered food from as far as India and Southeast Asia to Egypt and even points beyond. So they had the best that the entire world had to offer. And when Daniel and his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they see what is spread before them, they decide that they are not going to pollute themselves with the things of the king's table. And you'll recall what I mentioned about creation in the garden. They decide to eat just vegetables. And when God put man in a garden, he was a vegetarian. I've always thought that was interesting. So we know how the story goes on. Eventually, Daniel and his friends are promoted within the kingdom. And it was only in that next year that Nebuchadnezzar has his first dream. And this afternoon, what we're going to do is take a look at Daniel chapter 2 and the vision in Daniel chapter 7, and we'll just synthesize the two together. But I think it's critically important to keep the entire book in a theological frame. Because what Daniel is going to do is serve as a training manual for the Jews that Daniel is looking forward to. Because there's going to come a time in the not too distant future from Daniel's perspective where God's people, the Jews, are going to be harassed and persecuted and slaughtered in large numbers by a Greek king called Antiochus Epiphanes. And as we go through, we'll see that the pressure on these Jewish men, particularly Daniel, keeps getting ratcheted up and up. So in Daniel chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar tries to seduce him. In Daniel chapter 3, ironically, after seeing a vision of a statue, Nebuchadnezzar creates a statue of pure gold. And we'll consider that a little bit later, but he wants everyone to bow down to this image, and it's on pain of what? Death. If you don't bow down and worship this image, it's on pain of death. We'll see that with Antiochus Epiphanes. We'll also see it with another little horn that the book of Daniel talks about here in chapter 7. After seduction doesn't work, the next step is coercion and the prospect of having to give your life to maintain your status with God. And the last thing I'll point out, in Daniel chapter 4, we have what I would consider the theme of the book. So Nebuchadnezzar is going to receive his vision, and there's one message that God wants Nebuchadnezzar to learn and therefore tell others. And that is in Daniel chapter 4, verse 17. This decision is by the decree of the watchers and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. That's the point. That's the theological point of the book. We can talk about kings and kingdoms and armies and the clashes of these cultures and militaries, etc. But we have to understand from Romans chapter 13 and elsewhere that all authority on earth is delegated by who? God. He's got all of this under his purview, and he's also got all of it under control. That's why he can tell Daniel. When Daniel really wants to know something, Daniel can be told, go your way. Go your way and rest assured that on the last day you're going to receive your eternal inheritance. God's got everything under control. And that's one of these lessons that the Jews of Daniel's time and afterward are going to have to learn. And it becomes a training manual for the Christians of an earlier era than the one we're presently in, who are also going to be put to these same pressures. So Daniel and the history that it provides becomes a lesson in how to quietly and passively resist. Because when Daniel's life is again in danger, it's because he's doing something very simple. He's praying three times a day. And he's got enemies who want to have their revenge on him. So Daniel becomes an example of how God oversees everything and can work everything to his purposes. So that's where we'll pick up with the actual visions of Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 this afternoon, Lord willing. I appreciate the opportunity. It's good to be with you. God is going to do right by everyone. On the last day, on the judgment day, every account is going to be settled. And I just hope that everyone here can determine and reckon for themselves that from this day forward, when they wake up, that they're going to choose to worship and serve the Lord today. That's our lesson for this morning. If there's anything that this congregation can do for you, we invite you to come forward as we stand and as we sing.